You're listening to a Corridor Business Journal podcast. This episode of Real Success with Nate Kading is brought to you by Midwest One Bank. Midwest One Bank is the proud partner for doers and entrepreneurs in the corridor and beyond. As an SBA preferred lender, our team is ready to help you reach your business goals. It's Empowered Money Management. It's Midwest One Bank, member FDIC.
Ofer and Naftali, thank you so much for taking the time. You guys are I call you the hummus and falafel kings of the Midwest, at the very least, if not America. But we're lucky to have you here. As an Iowa City native, spend a lot of time both in your shop and buying your product off the shelves at Hy-Vee, amongst other places. And I know people in the corridor are very familiar with Oasis hummus, or visiting you guys here on the north side and in Iowa City. So I'm looking forward to chat with you guys today and learning a little bit more about your story and how y'all came to make a life and a business out of something as beautiful as hummus and falafel. But maybe we'll start there. Like, go back and, you know, what are your early memories of Mediterranean food or hummus or falafel? Like, what childhood memories or a special place that you grew up eating at? Maybe it was a parent's table or whatever, but how did you get introduced to this food?
For me, you know, I was born in Israel, in 1955, so I'm an old guy. and for me, in Israel, there's like maybe two types of people. One that came from Africa, like the northern part, and then some who came from Europe after the Holocaust. And my parents are from Poland. And so the Middle Eastern food wasn't so much in my house, but when I was outside the house, this is where, you know, you go to school and you go to a falafel shack and you buy your falafel. Actually, it started in the food at school. For example, I don't eat tomatoes.
Okay.
So the lady at the school knew that I don't eat tomatoes. So when there was falafel days, she used to make a pita for me with some hummus and some falafel balls. Didn't put tomatoes in.
Sure.
So this is how this thing started. I never thought that I'd be working in this area, but that was a long time ago. So this is how I was introduced to this. To this food, and then eventually you go into the army. And when I was, by the way, I didn't like hummus so much until I went into the army. But because I didn't eat too many things, I realized if I don't eat hummus, I'll probably die from hunger.
So I started, the other options weren't that great.
Yeah, better option wasn't there, so I started eating it.
Yeah,
so that's me.
I was born in Israel too, but I actually moved to Iowa City when I was three. My mom grew up in Iowa City. And when I was a kid, I was a pretty picky eater, but I'd go back to Israel and I would eat falafel, and you just couldn't get it here in Iowa City.
Right.
In the 80s, 1980s, like actually if anywhere in America you could get falafel in the 1980s, it was probably Iowa City. But then I moved to Chicago as a kid, and there was falafel there because it was a big city.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so bad. Like, it just wasn't good. And
how was it? Explain to me the difference between, if we were to take 1980s Midwestern falafel versus Naftali, the plate, you know, you grew up eating at these amazing shacks in Israel. Like, what? How would you describe the difference in that taste profile? Is it the ingredients? Is it some special spices? What is that?
Well, it's a street food, right? So there's typically not like a restaurant with seating. I mean, you can, but
it's like a window. Yeah, it's a small.
Yeah, it's a window. It's maybe even like almost just a table.
Sure.
But some places, like, they'll be on the corner and they will have 10 and 20 salads, and you just take your falafel and go to town on the salads. The temperate climate means it's always fresh veggies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a small country. It couldn't come from more than 100 miles away,
right.
200 miles max. So it's just like,
right.
It's healthy, you know, and just tasty. And For me, when we opened Oasis and we had a good product, I remember like the third day we were open, I thought we were so busy, you know, we were probably like five customers. I was like sitting on the on the steps to the basement, like inhaling a sandwich, and it tasted really good. And my brain added the diesel fumes because Tel Aviv is like a big city with a lot of buses, and like it just smells like diesel, you know. So when I eat the falafel, like the smell
takes you back, right?
Yeah, it took me back, and I was like, oh, we got it. Like this tastes right, you know, like diesel fumes. Maybe that's what we need, that touch of diesel fumes.
What he's not saying is, by the way, and this is part of our story, then when we started talking about doing falafel, you know, we took a recipe, and his dad, which unfortunately is no longer alive, Alash passed away like, what, a year ago? Less than this. But so we went to his house, and I was like, okay, you know, we invited all of our Israeli friends, and we said, we'll make falafel for you.
That's a good audience to bring.
A good audience. Tough very critics, yeah. Israelis knows how to criticize, so that was the whole idea. And our first balls just disintegrated in the oil. And it's like, I remember my wife looked at me and she said, are you serious? Do you really want to do this? It's like, but I said, no, we'll try again and try again. And finally we did. We did it, so.
Let's go back, as we're going to be talking a lot about falafel and hummus here for the next half hour or so. Just for the folks out there listening, that they know it, they tasted it, they've been around it, but they don't know exactly what goes into a falafel. Okay. Give us the quick 411 on the.
Let's start with falafel. So they're both made from chickpeas.
Okay.
And actually the word hummus means chickpea in a lot of languages.
So Middle Eastern climate grows good chickpeas. Where do you guys source your chickpeas from?
Ours come from Utah and Eastern Washington State and Western Wyoming.
So kind of an arid, that kind of high deserty climate.
They grow high and dry around the world: Canada, Mexico, Turkey, India. It's a good crop because it fixes its own nitrogen. You don't need to add nitrogen, and it's very high in protein and fiber, and it's pretty hardy, you know, and it stores great.
Sure, and you're buying bulk, just raw chickpea.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. We're buying truckloads of chickpeas from the good old U.S. of A. Mm-hmm. And it's awesome. Yeah, my dream is to get a train car, but
get the brand, the logo on back. It's like a beer truck, right?
Yeah,
like
a train car is something like 70 tons or something someday.
I love it. Yeah. So that chickpea is the main ingredient.
So chickpea is the main ingredient. When you make falafel, you soak the chickpeas, and they get not soft but crunchy. I mean, when they're raw, like you'd break your teeth on them.
Yep.
It's like eating rocks. But so they get kind of like an apple, you know, and then we grind it with a bunch of veggies and spices and make like a paste. And then we form that into a patty and fry it. And that's what a falafel is.
Mm-hmm. Like deep fried in vegetable oil.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then it goes into a sandwich, and the sandwich is also called falafel. Like you got a hot dog, and then the sandwich is also a hot dog. You don't say hot dog sandwich.
Okay.
See, and then you can say falafel pita, I suppose.
The beautiful sauces and all the things that you can add to them. And the meat, the proteins, and
it goes with any veggie, I think. And, you know, we have a mango sauce, goes great with like a sweet curry. Actually, the version of that in the Middle East that we were going for is much more sour and spicy, almost like a chutney. Oh, it's so good. There's so many, you can do anything with it. Okay, sorry. And then, so hummus is you take chickpeas and then you soak them. You soak them and then boil them. So you soak them into a mush.
Sure. Basically.
And then you add tahini, which is a sesame seed paste. It's like peanut butter from sesames. Very high in protein, vitamin E. And then oil and whatever seasonings you want. And that's hummus.
Great.
Right.
Just like everything in the Middle East, there's like confusion and debates about who invented everything. The Egyptians are saying we invented falafel, but they don't do it from chickpeas, they do it from fava beans or ful in the Arab language. And then of course everybody has his own recipe, so don't, and it's always secret recipe. It's not so secret, but everybody likes to make it secret. So
exactly. So that's like part of the good story.
We
use
cilantro in our falafel.
Okay.
And some places use parsley, some use both, and you know.
So take us into that the test kitchen. Yeah, we're thinking this is 2004, maybe a little bit before that. Mm-hmm. Take us back to that. You mentioned that you had your friends over, first one's disintegrated in the frying pan. Now go from that point to when you're like, okay, we're gonna, and you started with a food cart. Like, walk us through the first few months of when you guys were gonna take this product to market. Give us some stories from that time.
Well, we, as Ofer said, we wanted to do it in the arts festival. Mm-hmm. So we applied for
here in Iowa City.
Here in Iowa City, and we said, oh, that's a great place for people to taste our food and let us know if it's good or not. So we applied, and then they told us, you need to get a license from the health department. And we were thinking doing it in my house or here, house, whatever it is. And they said, no, you need to have a certified
kitchen.
You know, kitchen. It's like, where the heck am I going to get a certified kitchen? And then I realized, you know, Hillel here, the Jewish student organization, they have a kitchen because they do Shabbat dinner or Friday night dinner for the students. So I went to the director and I said, can I use your kitchen for this festival? And he said, yeah, but, you know, we are a private kitchen. We're not licensed. So I said, I'll license it. So I called the health department and they came in. We had to change a few things. And they basically licensed us the kitchen. And we said, okay, we bought some food. And we were like, it was 2.5 days at this time. And we said, we bought some food. And we said, oh, this will
probably... All the prep, all the build up.
Right, yeah. This will probably hold us for the 2.5 days. And then the 4 or 5 hours on Friday night it was open, everything disappeared, you know. At midnight, we went to Walmart and bought more stuff and was working.
Love it. Yeah. Was it Oasis right out of the gate? Was that the name and the first?
Well, we weren't festival? Sure. Yeah, Oasis is such a generic name. Mm-hmm. But my brother's friend, who's a graphic designer, worked for like George Lucas and Sony and all these. He's a really amazing guy. He developed this logo, and just as soon as we saw it, we're like, so good.
That's it.
It's Oasis, you know.
So was there, you mentioned the first day at the festival, it sold out. I mean, was there an education of the local, I mean, here we are in Iowa, right? Like, not the most ethnically diverse group or exposed to different kind of ethnic foods, where people walking by like, well, you know, where's the funnel cake stand here at this festival? What's this falafel stuff?
People were ready for it. I think we were well-timed. It was lucky, you know, like people knew what it was, and Iowa City deserved a falafel place by that, you know? So I think, yeah, I mean, less people know about it than now, but it wasn't so bad,
right?
You know?
So that was sort of the proof of concept, so to speak, was this one festival experience. And then from there, was it, let's find a brick and mortar.
We did Jazz Fest a month later.
And still went like hotcakes there, too?
Yeah, it was a good...
Well, this time we knew we have a place, too. So we could tell people that the first time... People say, oh, you should open a restaurant. I said, we're trying to. But we didn't have a space. Mm-hmm. But the Jazz Fest, we knew they were opening the Lynn Street, which is a story by itself, how we got it. But we knew that... So that was a good advertisement, and so...
And people were excited,
So the space here on Lynn Street, you know, of course, in the historic north side of just from downtown, next to, you know, John's Grocery, and over in this area.
And the Hamburger Inn.
And the Hamburger Inn, that's right, yeah. Yes. Talk about the first, you know, you opened in, I think, was it October of 2004, that first shop. What was it like? Was it intimidating? What are some of the emotions that you guys had as sort of first-time shop owners there?
Yeah, it was. You know, one thing we did right, I mean, it was a diner before that. There was already a restaurant there. So we didn't have
the hood and some of this.
Yeah, the big investments were already there. And that was lucky and smart. I don't think we realized how smart that was. And we really didn't do a lot. I mean, we did as little as we could to get it. And we also didn't really know. I mean, we made some changes. I don't even know why we did it, because we had no idea what we were doing. But it was fun. It was an exciting time. I think we took the place July 1, and we basically got open by October.
Wow.
We were like...
That's a quick turnaround.
That's quick. We were thinking we'll do it in a month.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Of course nothing works in a month.
Yeah.
And we opened in October, but...
So that first October, what was the biggest... we all know restaurants as consumers. It's just something that's part of everyone's life, right? What's the... People listening out there, what was the most surprising thing that you learned early on about running and owning a restaurant? that you hadn't thought about leading up to it?
That it's a business. You know, I came from the business world in the high tech, but I learned pretty fast, actually, before we opened, that it's a business. I remember my wife told me, it's like, what are you doing all those spreadsheets? You're going to open a restaurant. It's like, what's the sort? And it is a business. It's money, and you have to, if you don't have money, you're out. So, and one thing I didn't know, and I don't think he knew, is how do you run this thing? How is the food coming? And so we hired some people that were really good at this.
Yeah.
Expensive, but we actually didn't use them for more than 6 or 9 months. But they knew, well, they knew Cisco, then they knew, you know, US Foods and yeah. how to order and where to order. So the beginning, it gave us the time and efforts to do our menu.
I'm just marveling how little I knew about anything. I mean, I was like 26.
Learning on the fly, yeah.
I mean, I'd had a few jobs.
Right.
And a college degree, you know.
I think that's something we, you know, just being involved with restaurants myself that you – it's, I think, hard for people from the outside to understand this. And everybody, you know, knows food and you can cook, but it is such a, it literally is an entirely different thing doing it in a commercial restaurant kitchen from bulk ordering and staffing and how to hit peak times and what happened. You know, it's lunch rush. Like, how are you, the throughput of turning out 20 falafel sandwich, you know, and now you guys have online ordering and it's like, it's an entirely different beast to do it in a commercial setting versus at home with for a dinner party or something.
You know, one thing that I say to people right now, and I'm trying to help as much as I can to other business owners, like, is the fact that you don't know everything, and you ask for help. And some people have the pride of saying, I know the best, and I know my food, and I know this, and they will not ask for help. And we ask for help. And he, especially his brother and he, they knew everybody in town. It's like, oh, we need some electricians. Like, oh, yeah, we'll call this guy. And we need this. Because so that was really helpful at the beginnings. You can ask for help and you can ask for advice. And don't be ashamed. You know, that's something
Was there a moment you guys remember early on that first fall where you're like, we might have something here? Or was it a quick kind of... Yeah. The city took right to it, or was it a slow build up? Or
no, I think like people were excited right away, and I think we're really lucky for that. I mean, it does seem like it just caught on. Like that's how I remember it. I mean, I guess 20 years ago. So I think that moment of like sitting, like I said, in the stairwell with the diesel fumes. I imagine these diesel fumes, you know, and because it tasted like home, you know.
Sure.
And that. It just seemed like a good idea. Like, it tastes good, it's cheap, it's healthy, you know, it's even environmentally pretty sound. And it's right here on the north side, you know?
Yeah.
Also, listen, this is the one thing we learned pretty fast, I did especially, is listen to your customers. And you listen to your customers by just approaching them or just by sitting in the restaurant and actually listen to them talk to each other. And find out the advice. You know?
Yeah, that's a great point. What was some of that early either direct feedback or things you overheard? What were some of the tweaks you guys made in your first year or so of operation? New menu items or ways you're doing it?
Oh, one thing, like, so in Israel they kind of do it like when you go to a Subway restaurant and you get the bread and then they kind of go through each item and point at it and then you say yes or no and then you
like
go
a build your own like a Chipotle or something.
And we tried that concept for maybe a month. And I don't know why it was the way we had it set up, but people just were not understanding. So we just changed it to like, okay, it comes with this.
Right.
You know, and actually we still have it that way. But that was an example of just what we thought would be for sure how we're going to do it.
Yeah.
And that was wrong.
Another example is like, I love spicy food.
Mm-hmm. So do I.
And I thought that everybody loves spicy food and they don't. And so our falafel at the beginning was really spicy.
Huh.
And we had one customer, he still lives in Iowa City, Hani Al-Khali. He was actually an Egyptian. He was the physician of President Sadat, actually, in Egypt.
Really?
And he's an artist and everything. And he loves our food. And he sits there one day and he said, you know, Naftali, you're killing me. And I said, why am I killing you? He said, your falafel is too spicy. I said, you're Egyptian. You need to like falafel. You know? And he said, no. It's not good for me. It's making me like, And I just then realized it's not about me. It's about other people. And right. and we yeah. changed it. We took it down a little bit. So
now you can do what I do, which is I come in and I just layer it on with that green
yeah,
hot sauce.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'll find a way to make mine spicy. Trust right. me. That stuff's
but,
good.
But if it's in the basic food, then you cannot do this.
Yeah.
So anyway.
That's, yeah, that's always important, getting that feedback yeah. and pivoting and tweaking as you go along. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, all of us know the great little spot here on the north side, but then of course there's also the hummus that's made its way out into the world and the supermarket shelves, and I think it's 7 different states now. And so when did that whole process start? And I think that's another fascinating piece. You go from just being a sole restaurant owner, now you're a manufacturer and a distributor and all of the other complexities that come along with that. When did the hummus operation take root? And
pretty much right after we opened. So we opened in October of 2004. And by, I think, 2006, customers come to us and
want to take it home.
They yeah. say, yeah, why don't you package it or sell it at the co-op or sell it at Hy-Vee? And so we thought, well, that's a pretty good idea, you know? And we talked to the health department, and they said, just put a label with, you need your address and whatever, you know.
Wait, they were very helpful, yeah. the health department here.
No, so. Yeah, the health department, they know a lot. If you're going to design a restaurant, you should talk
them
to them
in early.
Save some money. Yeah,
yeah. yeah.
And though if they'll remember you if you ask questions, or they like it. So the first store we went to is North Dodge Hy-Vee?
And you were making it out of the restaurant.
Yeah, we're doing
producing
it
out of your current restaurant.
That's yep. right. And we were only putting a week shelf life on it. You
okay.
know? So it's, you know. We were just making it, scooping it.
The first one was North Dodge, Hy-Vee, as I said before.
Yeah, so we went to North Dodge. Actually, they were great. All those Hy-Vees have been great, but just so you know, if anyone listening, they told Naftali no on, like, Tuesday, and then that was the assistant manager.
you got to find the guy on top.
The manager yeah. was gone, so the guy said no, and then Naftali came back the very next day, and a different guy said yes. So...
Naftali doesn't take no very well. Is that the moral
of
the story?
Well, that is, yeah. No, I mean, it matters, you know. And even still, like, yeah, we've expanded a lot, but we're trying to go into Chicago, and if the manager, the owner, whatever, has a bad attitude, I don't try to sell my hummus.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not trying to talk him into it.
Sure.
You know, they need to have a good attitude, positive people, you know. Right. Just save yourself the trouble.
Right.
So
how you remember how big that first order was that Hy-Vee made? Okay. How many?
12 containers.
A dozen,
six
yeah.
maybe.
And how did that work?
Something else that helped us. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go for it.
It wasn't only the hummus that we sold out. Then we came up with this idea of having those packs. They would have a 4 ounce of hummus and a 4 ounce of Mediterranean salad and a pita bread.
Mm-hmm.
And we were thinking, this can be a great hit. Well, what the university is here, let's sell it to the students. But how do you do it? So I went to the IMU department, and this time the food director over there was Barry Greenberg, a good friend of ours, and I said, Barry, can we sell it here at you? And they had like 10, 12 coffee shops all over the university, and we said, can we sell it? And he said, you know, you came at exactly at the right time. And I said, what do you mean exactly in the right time? He said, we get a lot of complaints from parents that we don't have good food.
Not healthy enough.
And this right. is something that can help. And we started putting it on the shelves, and it worked like crazy. People loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, we ended up opening 4 of those cafes ourselves in the university, which we don't have anymore because it was not for our main business. And we shut them down, but that was also a great thing that helped us, you know. Then in addition to the restaurant, you have another business running. We still called it Oasis.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a different name until like
the little outpost
2020
the
or something. Yeah.
yeah. What? So on the distribution side, what are the mechanics of how that works? Is there a third party that helps deliver all your products across the different places, or how does? And where are you manufacturing this? Let's fast forward to present day. Like, how much hummus are you making? How do you distribute it? Let's talk a little about this production business.
So we were making it at the restaurant. I mean, from that point, it just grew and grew and grew. And then we were in all the Hy-Vees in town, and I think at one point, Waterfront Hy-Vee said, like, we want 150 containers twice a week.
Wow.
And they were on consignment. And so I said, yeah, I'll bring it, but, like, I can't give you consignment. You know, like, we're done with that. And they said, fine. And it just kept going and going and going, you know. And then we bought a refrigerated truck, and then we bought a second one, and then we bought a third one. And we were making hummus 7 days a week at the restaurant. We would start at 3 a.m.
Jeez.
There's an urban myth that we used to make it in the basement. And just to clarify, it's not true. We've never made hummus in the basement.
You're not allowed to do food in the basement. So
when you say we are making it at 3 a.m., like, is that, like, do you have a head production person? Or
well,
is
we
that
did. Yeah, we were. So this is still in the past. So, but we were making it 7 days a week, and we were just making as much and storing it and delivering it 7 days a week, too, as quickly as we could.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it was nuts. So,
what's the shelf life on hummus? How does that...
Well,
got to be refrigerated the entire time after
it's
made?
Yeah, it's very sensitive, especially without preservatives, like we make it. And 2 to 3 weeks, basically.
Okay.
So we put a 16-day sell-by date, and depending on how you treat it or how, you know, if you double dip a lot, it'll might get some mold on it around 20 days.
Okay.
But it'll go stale and taste bad before it's actually, like, really bad.
Right.
And that's the thing. It gets old, you know, and that's part of the appeal.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, it's a natural food that we made in the kitchen and then it went bad.
Yeah. Where do you guys produce now, the hummus?
So now we make it outside of town, like near Kelowna.
Okay.
And we have a dedicated room there. It's like FDA facility,
mm-hmm.
USDA, SQF, you know, so you have all the...
Kosher.
Kosher, yeah, it's kosher. Gluten-free, dairy-free. We have all the licenses and stuff. So because we were selling it to the grocery stores and the local county health license, which is totally cool. It's actually statewide. But some big companies want, you know, they want more certifications.
Right.
Blah, blah, blah. You know, and we're happy to have that. I mean, that place is clean.
Mm-hmm.
It's really great. Like, that is a clean room where we make our hummus right now. It's really cool. And so we make, you know, a couple tons a week.
Oh, wow.
And
is that your metric? What's the hummus world? You know, like in the beer world, it's like, you know, pallets or whatever, you know.
Yeah, pallets.
What's your unit? What's your
case,
unit
a case,
name?
Six or 9 pound case.
6 or 9 pound, a case, yeah. Okay.
So we always need more. And it's a challenge because, like, so we were making at the restaurant and distributing it ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And business was great, but it wasn't really sustainable because, like, we wouldn't be able to, for example, be in Costco with, like, a county health license, you know. And so going to, like, a bigger manufacturing setting, we were, you know, enabled us to go to Hy-Vee Central Distribution, so any Hy-Vee store, in theory, can order our hummus anytime. Yeah. And sometimes they do, you know. And we can go to Costco now and it's pretty cool, but you know, there's the distributors, we don't have our own trucks. And so it's starting to eat away at your profit. And it's more of a hustle now than it was when we were little because, the margins are smaller.
Right. Do you no longer self-distribute or you still do?
We do, but not really. Okay. I mean, just sort of.
What he's missing in between, making the hummus here on Lynn Street and then going to Kelowna is the fact that one day we get a phone call from corporate Hy-Vee and there's a EVP over there and it said, hey, can you guys come talk to us in Des Moines at headquarters? And I said, I was thinking they wanted to get us out of Hy-Vee. and we said, of course we'll come, you know. And we came and actually he said, we saw the numbers of how much Hy-Vee's Iowa City Coralville is selling. And we looked at your story and we love it. So we want you to go into our central distribution. And that was the key of saying, okay, we can no longer do it at the restaurant. We have to find something better.
The demand was there. So then that kind of gave you the confidence to take that big leap forward with the business.
Yeah. And then Costco came too, which is, we are now in 5 Costco locations. 4 in Iowa, and 1 in Omaha. And it's another funny story. we used to buy a lot of food from Costco here, like lamb and other things. And the employees actually over there loved our hummus. And they went to the management and said, why don't you bring the hummus inside Costco, sell it here? And they got in touch with us and said, let's do something together, but Costco need to be unique. And they said, we said, well, how do we do it unique? Okay, if we do 8 and 16 ounce at Hy-Vee, at Costco, we'll do 24 ounce. Okay. So now Costco on the shelf have a case with 6 packs of 24 ounces
That's
of
really
hummus.
Cool.
That's a lot of hummus.
Yeah.
So,
how would you characterize, just out of curiosity, the difference between working with a Hy-Vee and Costco? How are their methods for dealing with vendors different? Or, I mean, how, just generally speaking?
It is a bit different. I mean, Hy-Vee is vastly larger. So if you think about it, like, there's a Hy-Vee in Coralville, right? And the next one is in Des Moines. I mean, sorry, there's a Costco in Coralville, and the next one's in Des Moines.
Right.
So in that same area, there's probably 100 Hy-Vees for every Costco.
It's crazy.
So it's almost like a different business, like a different kind of business.
Mm-hmm. But you have one main point of contact now that you're going to central distribution, or are you still...
Yeah, local. But you know, to get into a specific Hy-Vee location, you need to persuade the deli manager to take the product because they gave them the right of refusal.
Okay.
So they don't force unless you are, you know, Sabra or other one that has 50% of the market, then they say whatever they want, and that's what happened. Right. But for us, it's like, okay, we have to go store by store and persuade them.
The Hy-Vees are pretty autonomous, which is cool. And people say, ask me, how do I get into...
That is cool. They give the, some leeway like, to be local. And
how do I get my whatever into the local Hy-Vee? Just go talk to them, you know? Especially if you'd be like, can I bring 12? And if they don't sell, I won't invoice you.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
What are they, why wouldn't they? And they're pretty good about that. And it's not altruism. Like, they make money on it. You know, like, the people in the neighborhood want the product. I think with Costco, like, by that time, we were already in 50 or 100 Hy-Vee stores. So, you know, and they can look up the, you know, there's business data. They can go research it, and there's, you know, public, you pay for it, but you can get registered data from the grocery industry.
Yep.
If you do a report on hummus, like, our brand is up there with, you know, with the top brands in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
let's talk about that for a second, because I don't know when it happened, but sometime in the last, you guys tell me, the last 5-10 years, you know, you would go to a Casey's before or a Come and Go or something, and like there wasn't any hummus. You know, like now it's like almost like a staple. You know, that's like the go-to healthy snack. If I can make my way past like the Slurpees and the breakfast pizza, and like I actually have the, you know, the willpower to resist those not good for you things. Like that's usually the go-to, right? Is like hummus. Like it seems to be more of a staple in the American diet and found its way into those sort of areas. Where and when did you guys notice that inflection point in the American, like in this, let's say Iowa or Midwestern market where you, the hummus really started to come onto the scene from a competitive standpoint?
It coincided with when we started the company and,
so early aughts. Like,
yeah. It probably started just before that, and definitely 100% it's because of the company Sabra.
Sabra?
Yeah, which was originally actually an Israeli company, but now is 51% owned by PepsiCo. So it's basically like indistinguishable from any other giant, massive corporation. And they basically introduced better – I mean, at the time – When Sabra came to the U.S., I knew the brand in Israel, and I loved the hummus because I was so much better than the hummus you could get in the U.S. And now that same hummus I deride, and I think it's horrible because I'm used to my own hummus. You know, so I was excited when Sabra came to the U.S.
Where is it manufactured in the U.S.?
Pennsylvania, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, they may have some other plants, but I think the main one's in Pennsylvania. And they probably make like 20 million pounds a year, like that. I mean, it's really bonkers. But they introduce everyone to hummus, which is cool. But and back to that, like, even right now I encounter this in Chicago. People don't actually know that hummus can taste good because they're familiar with the national brands, which are very sour. They're highly
preservative.
They're preserved and stabilized.
Let's just keep rattling off the ways that theirs are worse than our favorite.
And so when I go to Chicago, I'll be like, hey, I have this premium hummus.
Yeah.
and it's very expensive, but it's really good. And they don't believe me that there's such a thing. They know. They think they know what hummus tastes like because of these other brands.
Yeah,
and you know, and it's not true. But so it's our challenge to introduce people to it. And
how much more expensive is an Oasis premium hummus versus your typical run of the mill Sabra?
Vastly. What retailers buy our hummus for is more than they sell other hummuses for.
Which is sometimes killing us, but you know, it is what it is. You know, the ingredients are expensive.
The ingredients are better.
Pros and cons of from your guys' perspective of having a premium product, a direct to consumer product that you're selling to be in the premium category versus, you know, the lower end, kind of more affordable. Like, that was obviously a conscious decision for you guys not to cut any corners and do it the right way, like, in positioning yourselves in that manner. Talk a bit about the pros and cons of having a premium product in the marketplace.
Well, okay, that's on my mind all the time. So, like, we're trying to grow into Chicago, and it's like, we can do demos at stores. It's very expensive. It could be like just the labor, $50 an hour, plus, you know, all the materials or whatever. It could be like $75 an hour, and you hand out 20 units. It's really not very good money. You know what I mean? You paid $20 to get. I mean, it would literally be cheaper to just give it away. But like, for some reason, like, nobody wants to just give stuff away. I mean, I would do it. It would work. And then you're like, okay, we'll do a price discount. But some people are like, oh, you don't want, you know, your brand is better. It's worth it. You don't want to mark it down. But it's like, well, how do I introduce somebody to it? Because actually what happens with our hummus is once somebody tries it, they'll be like, oh, it's expensive, right?
But it's not about expensive. Not the price, it's the value. People appreciate it and they're willing to pay more for hummus.
Well, there's
quality.
A cycle. So they might have it one time. Uh-huh. And then the next time they go buy hummus, they're like, damn, it's expensive. I'll buy the cheap one. So they buy the cheap one again. But then it sucks. And then everyone at their house is like, hey, let's get that other stuff again. So it takes a while. Because they do, like, and I hear from all daily, I hear from people like, oh, if I bring home the other hummus, like, everyone's pissed. And it just sits there, like, you know? Like my kids.
And you also need to remember, but as Ofer said, with time, again, one, because Sabra introduced the U.S. to hummus, there's more and more people who are manufacturing hummus. And we realize that if we take our value down and our price down because of bad ingredients, then we are the same as everybody else. And so why people will buy from us or not? So we basically decided, okay, we'll leave it as it is. We'll try to make it a little bit cheaper, but not more than this. Yeah. And then, you know, if people don't want to buy it, that's fine, you know. Something that we, you know, every time we are going to introduce like a couple of two or three flavors soon because that's what the market is demanding.
I was going
to
ask you about that, yeah.
And doing all of this requires us to do a lot of tastings and everything. And people, actually his brother is calling us hummus snobs because there's a little of a change. And we said, no, we don't want this. And if you give it to people who... most of them will not even notice this. Mm-hmm. Right. But it is our brand. It is our product. And we will not let it go if it's...
So you have, you're saying you've got some new flavors coming out of hummus?
Yeah, this is a
scoop. Is this a breaking... Yeah. Are we going to get scooped here? This is awesome. Yeah. This is a Corridor Business Journal scoop.
Like,
can you share one or two now?
We're
going to
have two flavors. One will be red pepper garlic lovers.
Oh, yeah.
And...
garlic lovers.
Yeah, that's right. Oh. Or is it... I don't remember. Is it
sign me up for both. That sounds
garlic
amazing.
Garlic lovers possessive or for garlic lovers plural?
Whatever. It works. Both of them work.
Or both. Plural possessive.
Yeah, do the apostrophe after the S. Like, just give it a little flourish. Well, that sounds amazing.
And you know what happened to me is what happens to our customers. We were discussing new flavors, and we said, what about red pepper hummus? And the fact is I've only ever had red pepper hummus that was mass-produced with these national brands. So I said, why? It's garbage. Red pepper hummus is bad. but then we made a batch.
And it's good.
And it was good. And we got a really, it's really.
So it's like a red pepper paste?
This
or
is a
how
podcast,
it,
right? So I can swear. Can I
swear? Yeah, absolutely.
It's really fucking good.
Is it red pepper paste or how do you?
It's red bell pepper.
Uh-huh.
They're dry. We use it dried.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we do the hummus process, it rehydrates. It's very, very clever and so delicious.
That sounds amazing.
So I fell prey to like, what is our challenge with customers in general? They're like, oh, hummus. And they think of Sabra or some other national brand. They're like, ugh. And so I did the exact same thing. And the garlic one,
I love
it's super garlicky for me. I think of our original hummus, which we now we're calling original hummus, it is garlicky already, and I don't really like the new one. But I don't want to. But some people love a mouthful of garlic, and that's great because now we got options, you know. And I think
you can be fun. You get a, you get all the good data. You'll back to your original thing from the first days, right? You'll get people will tell you what they like and what they like more than others, and that's fun.
Yes. And it's a process. It's an expensive process. You need to do a lot of cycles and test again and again and again.
Hurt your waistline a little bit. You got to keep eating. Yeah. And
we've got a third flavor that we don't know when we'll be able to do that one, and then a whole bunch of ideas. And then out from the restaurant, we also, we're doing frozen falafel bags of 10, and we've got those in the local groceries, basically Iowa City, maybe. Co-op in Cedar Rapids has it, but that'll get around, and those are really delicious. You just take it home and heat it up in your oven or air fryer. You don't need to fry it. They're already fried, fully cooked, just frozen, and
it's great.
Those are cool. Yeah.
How do you guys manage goals within your business, and how do you guys work together as business partners to set those goals? I think that's always something really interesting with small business owners, especially as I'm hearing your story, you guys have seemed to be very opportunistic in your growth. And when you've seen demand, that's when you've grown. Are you guys write it down on paper and put it up on the bulletin board? We want to sell X amount of tons of hummus a year. Or is it just sort of steady, slow and steady sort of growth? Do you have 1 year goals, 5 year goals? What does that look like for you guys? And how do you manage that amongst your partnership?
It's more the FOMO that we need, you know. We see the demand, and then we decide, okay, let's do this, and then we start working on this. One thing, if Ofer and I, as I said at the beginning, I don't know if it was recorded or not, but I'm like 68 years old. September I'll be 69. He's like almost half of my age, and it worked, And it's like, again, people are saying if it's not for Naftali and Ofer will never succeed. But we listen to each other, we work with each other, we trust each other. It's something that small business owners sometimes don't have.
And you can go farther together, right? As opposed to one or the other.
Together. I'll give you an example. One day I go and there is a safe at the basement at the Oasis. And I open the safe and there's a note from Ofer, I owe you $1. And I said, what the heck is this? And he said, I had to take it out. And he was not joking. That was him, saying
that's
this.
That's a good business partner there to have.
It's a good business model.
So. Well, and then there was, I went to my high school 25th reunion or whatever, and we went out 3 a.m. for pancakes or whatever. I was told everyone, I'll buy pancakes. And then 2 weeks later, Naftali said, he was going over the bills. The restaurant bills, and he said, "Were you at a Waffle House in Chicago, Illinois?" And I was like, oops, I pulled out the wrong.
Yeah, the wrong credit card. I've been there. Yeah, a few dozen beers in you. Would you say that one of the two of you is more growth driven? Like, do you guys have any sort of friction around like, let's expand the manufacturing, let's go open another do you guys usually see pretty eye to eye on that? On that front, because the businesses I'm involved with, that's usually some of the healthy conversation. But there's always someone that's like, "I want to do 50 of these." Other ones like, "Hey, I think life's pretty good right now."
We're both pretty good about dreams or ideas, Actually, back to what you asked, how do we organize the business? It's like that's what I was working on this morning. It's been 20 years, and it's been pretty ad hoc. Like, not a lot of plans or not the way an MBA would want to see it done.
Sure.
And so now we are actually trying to build those systems and stuff. And it's a challenge, because it's complicated.
Yeah. Your business has gotten bigger and therefore more complicated and,
yeah,
and different things.
Yeah, and you can't things keep everything
have... in your head. Right.
That's
one thing we did, and it came naturally, is that the fact that we split responsibilities mm-hmm. by the strength of each one of us.
Yep.
I was doing more the accounting and the spreadsheets and everything. He took over because he knew people in town, you know, building stuff, all the mechanics behind it, which I'm not good at. So somehow there was a split of responsibilities, and each one of us knew what the other is doing, and we said, okay, you know, that's yep. how it works, you know. Now we have, you know, we have a general manager who was with us almost from day one, and the operation manager, so Zach and Sarah, they're basically running the place, giving us the opportunity to concentrate on the hummus and the distribution and manufacturing and everything. And we are there almost yep. every day too, so.
Yeah.
How have you guys seen the food industry change over the course of the last 20 years from what consumers want? Let's talk specifically inside of your shop. I mean, how have you seen the restaurant industry change? How have you seen consumer demands change? And then this is a two-part question. What if you fast forwarded 5 years, trends or some things that you might morph and shift towards, like, what do you, you know, there's takeout, there's the online order, there's some of those sort of things, but is there something that you've noticed that's really been impactful to your business that's been a big change over the last 20 years?
There's a huge sudden shift during COVID was permanent, which was like a carryout mm-hmm. and online ordering thing.
Yep.
I mean, COVID's order and dining rooms are, COVID is over and dining rooms are open and stuff, but restaurants are still doing
takeout,
you know, whether it's Chomp or whatever, Uber Eats.
And your business was really well positioned for that just by the nature of, like you said, back to the roots.
Short order, reasonably cheap
stall, you know, the falafel stall.
Exactly. And that stuck around to the point where, like, we actually struggled to have enough seating at the restaurant because we have so many to go and pick up orders still. Mm-hmm. So we need that waiting space for people who are just waiting for orders.
Right.
And so that's a challenge, and it's interesting. And I mean, and I order food online still too, and I never did before COVID.
Yeah.
And COVID's long over.
You guys have a really nifty, my office is right down by your shop. I mean, you have a really well ingrained online ordering system into your website, yeah. which is really easy to get.
We did, we kind of hobbled through COVID, and then when COVID was ending, we were really wounded, and it was struggling. Everybody was struggling, but we had to rejigger the kitchen to get faster. We had to invest a little money. We lost some seating area because we needed more room to just make more food, which is great, but we needed to make it faster.
Yep.
Which sometimes you just need to expand in space. Mm-hmm. So you can save in time. Get too esoteric.
Yeah, but you guys hit something, a timeless chord, right? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, this is food that has been around for thousands of years. Yeah. You pioneered and brought to a new market
good,
that wasn't
man.
Used to it. So
I
it's,
love eating our food.
Yeah, you can
all the
see,
time.
You know, and the fresh and the healthy element and the ethnic food. I mean, these are things that we need more of. And
going back to your question about how people change the way they look at food. Is I think people now want more healthy food.
Yep.
They want to see the food is with like good ingredients, mm-hmm. and if it's without preservatives, it's without preservatives, and they demand it. It wasn't like this, like, you know, 25 years ago. You go to a restaurant and you knew that the food is okay, you know, unless like a high level restaurant or something. But getting to, you know, restaurants like ours. And at the beginning, people say, oh, I love the taste, I love this. Now I love the fact that it's no preservative, it's healthy food, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how people change. And then I think it will keep changing as it is. So.
Yeah, I think it's the restaurant food is similar to the hummus that after you eat it, it might take a few times, but then you feel better, you know, because you just ate a thing full of beans and cabbage. It's not like you ate a huge hamburger. I love burgers, you know, and I'm not trying to rag on my
favorite feel good
burger
after
places,
you're done.
But
yeah.
Like Oasis is like, you're eating lentils, you're eating cabbage, you're eating parsley, like you're getting the fiber, like you're getting all that stuff. And a little bit of shawarma, chicken shawarma in there too. Why not? Like why?
Yeah.
It's amazing. And it's really makes it affordable and just healthy, you know? And
yep.
Oh, now my mouth is watering. I mean, people text me all the time. My friends text me all the time, like almost nightly, like, I'm at your shop right now. And I'm like, damn.
Yeah.
Like, that it works. You know, it's funny because people see me and then they'll be like, oh, I saw you and then I got some Oasis. Because, like, Pavlov, you know?
Yeah.
But
it's all part of your magic, your trick.
People text me, and then I have to go get Oasis.
I like it.
And, like,
that's good.
On principle, I won't order it on Chomp, so sometimes it's, like, 7 p.m., and I'm like, damn, I got my pants on and go down to the restaurant.
So we're talking to a lot of folks this year for our podcast, local business owners, and around kind of generations and, you know, businesses that have been handed down from one generation to the next. And, Naftali, you said that you're – you know, a little bit older than Ofer. I don't know if you guys, have you guys started the conversation of, like, you know, when and if that comes from a business transition and how that would look into this next group? Is that some of your employees beyond Ofer, or how does that,
well,
when you walk off into the sunset?
I have three boys, you know, and none of them live in Iowa City, two in high tech, one is in the business, in the hedge fund. And none of them want to go into the restaurant business. Mm-hmm. So, and I ask, believe me, I ask.
Yeah.
And they don't. And it's fine, I understand. So, yeah, we need to think about, you know, what's next. It's not an easy decision even to start thinking about this, but with age, you know, my wife is a professor in the university. She will retire at one point of time, you know, and then I'll, you know, both of us will eventually. But, yeah, we need to start thinking about who takes it, and the fact that he's younger, way younger.
Yeah. And you guys are Ofer about this being your life's work. I mean, you mm-hmm. mentioned Sabra, and they sold a controlling share to PepsiCo. Like, right. is the ultimate goal for this at some point in time to be passed down to the next local group of Iowa Cityans to own Oasis and usher it into the next era? Is the goal to sell it to, you know, whomever, you know, that's out there, you know, Hy-Vee, a white label? I don't know. Like, have you guys thought, what is the next, what's the 20-year goal from now?
You know, that's a good question. Yeah, stay alive. I mean, we're still, in a way, actually recovering from COVID, surprisingly. So we're trying to return to profitability or full profitability. And I think any business owners listening or to this podcast will agree, you know, like, if you're not going to sell it, you know, make some money. And then if you're making money, who cares if you sell it or not? So that's where we're trying to get to, you know what I'm saying? I do want to say that we have our, and I think Zach and Sarah are our manager and our operations manager, like, they've been with us a long time, Zach almost 20 years and Sarah at least 15 or so or close. And, like, they really, they're the future of, and we're going to introduce them in our social media. And people should know, like, it's been a hard road. And I don't know if it would still be here if they weren't so committed and so good. Like, they've got a great crew. The communication's awesome. It's fun. That's really gratifying. And, you know, they have families now. They got kids.
Yeah, it's awesome.
You know, some of them. One of the, met their spouse at Oasis working there, you know, mm-hmm. and they have kids, so it's like an Oasis kid.
Yep, those are the cool stories. Yeah.
Those are really gratifying, you know.
Yeah. So last question for those out there that either eat a lot of Oasis hummus or haven't yet to be introduced to, give me your perfect dipping vessel for Oasis hummus. Is it the pita chip? Is it a carrot? Is it so, like, what's, like, your perfect, if you could eat Oasis hummus one last time, what would accompany the hummus? How would you go about doing
it? That's a good one.
For me, it's a pita bread.
Like, just always, a pita bread.
That's how.
Yeah. And just the hummus.
I was raised that I was like, and dip it. Don't eat it with a fork. Like, take a piece of pita and, like, mash it
dip
out.
Dip right in.
And you doing some olive oil on there, some garlic, or just what's the anything else? Or just
olive oil. The garlic is not needed. The hummus has enough garlic in it. Mm-hmm. But that's what I
pita bread. Maybe a little drizzle of olive oil.
And drizzle of olive oil.
Oh God, now I'm hungry.
Ofer, how about you?
Well, the Oasis fries.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that. We got a lot to talk about. Fries, the green hot sauce, the Oasis fries are amazing.
All of it's so good.
See, now I go, every time I order for lunch, I'm like, I'm going to have a nice, healthy lunch. I get your new bowl with the rice, which is amazing. And chicken shawarma, and I dump a bunch of the green hot sauce on it, and it's got the, you know, the falafel and the hummus in it. But then I'm like, shit, I got to order some fries, too. Right, and then it just eliminates my healthy lunch meal, you know. But
so order it online. So you're not, like,
you can resist it.
You can resist it, yeah.
Yeah, well, I try, but it doesn't work. What's your hummus
My hummus thing?
Your favorite hummus
pita bread,
meal.
That's good. It really is nothing like a nice, big, soft pita bread. With some hummus on it? Yeah.
Yeah. Perfect. With this new red pepper hummus.
Yeah, oh, damn. That's
the
so
one.
Good. Yeah.
Yeah, that will take a few more weeks because we're ordering the containers.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
We'll look for when? The summer? Like a summer thing?
It'll be June.
June?
Yeah.
Well, good. We'll throw a nice big party and enjoy some hummus together.
Definitely.
Thank you guys so much for taking the time.
So
yeah, this has been fun and appreciate everything you guys do.
Fun for us. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. I'd also like to thank Midwest One Bank for sponsoring this podcast. You can learn more and experience simply better banking at midwestone.bank. And this podcast is produced by Upload Media Group, located in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. For more information on them, you can visit uploadmediagroup.com. And of course, if you enjoy this show, please consider subscribing and reviewing on your podcast platform of choice. It helps us to continue to develop and grow. Real Success with Nate Kading is a Corridor Media Group podcast. For more information, visit CorridorBusiness.com.